All right, we are at Splash 2010 with the great Dave Thomas. Thanks for coming on Channel 9.
Oh, great, Charles. It's good to be back.
And, excellent.
You guys do a great job getting the straight goods out from some pointy-headed people. So some with opinions, some not.
Absolutely. Well, you know, let's talk a little bit about, this is sort of, Splash is, this year contains Oopsla and Bop and other things. Tell me a little bit about the history of these events.
Well, there was a small group of people. We got together just before the first conference in Portland in 86. And we sat around a table at IBM, and we all said, well, this is going to be a great conference. There'll probably be 60 or 70 people there, you know, all talking about objects and, you know, virtual machines and how we implement them. And there was this one lady, Angela Coppola, who was in the room, and she worked for the U.S. government. And she says, I think you ought to be thinking about 300 or 400. Mm. And we said, no way. This is a small conference, implementers. Okay, we'll plan for maybe 120, 150. And it was, you know, it blew the place out. I mean, I don't know what the numbers were, but they were towards 1,000. You know, they were, and it just became a great convergence of people, because it brought together, you know, people who actually did real software, you know, mm-hmm. researchers. People who wanted to learn, and so it became a real experience. Now, over time, of course, there's things happened other than objects, and a lot more conferences on, and so on. So, I think that one of the things that the clever things that the steering committee did was really try and expand this thing with regard to Splash, mm-hmm. and try and broaden it so it wasn't just only about objects; it was about other things, and that, you know, brings in conferences like PLOP. You know, like the conference, you know, GPCZ, the conference on generative programming.
Cool.
You know, a lot of the workshops and so on, and the dynamic languages conference, of course, which is always near and dear to my heart. So they have their conference on Monday.
Excellent.
And I think bringing together all these things, plus having outside speakers like amazing, you know, mm-hmm. Ivan Sutherland to kick things off this morning. I mean,
really,
you know,
interesting.
You know, you can't top something like that. Just puts out all the hard problems, says, folks, you know, I'm kind of, you know, I'm feeling like him, I'm kind of done. You know, it's good that it be done early, because it was easy when we were doing it.
And yes.
And now it's really hard, but putting the challenges out there, it's great. So I think they've done a good job, and a great crowd, and I think a lot of energy. Still a lot of old faces, but I'm still meeting people. Oh, finally, I've come to my first Oopsla, right? You know, so I think that's good.
It's excellent. It's excellent. Yeah. Now, speaking in some sense, what Ivan was talking about today with sort of the way that we need to change the way we think about parallel programming and concurrency, changing words that we use to describe how we solve them in software. What do you think about what he talked about today? I mean, how do you feel about, and I guess my specific question would be, it seems like the hardware needs to evolve in addition to what you guys are doing.
Yeah, well, I definitely think that the hardware software co-design has been something that we've often dreamed about, but only in a few areas. The FPGA community, some of the people in the financial area, signal processing, they've actually spent a fair bit of time taking hardware and software people and putting them together and synthesizing kind of hardware that matches the software problem. I think we need to do a lot more of that. Often it seems that I was a double E, but, you know, it's sort of, you know, the classic story is, hi, I'm here from hardware, I'm here to help you, and they sort of listen to you, but they kind of delete some of the requirements, say, well, you can make up that gap with software, and often it's harder to, you know, talk to the new hardware than it was just to talk to the old hardware. So, but I think the other problem is the hardware community tends to have to optimize to last year's benchmarks, so they're stuck with an industry workload that isn't representative. So when things change to using objects from, you know, procedural programs, or when things change to the web, all the workloads that they're using, which they've used for years, no longer represent what people are doing. So I think that makes it pretty challenging for the hardware guys too. But I do think we need to spend a lot more time learning. And one of the problems, I think, in computer science is we really don't. Today, most students, and we may know how to build an adder, but we certainly don't know anything about, you know, the fact that, you know, It's essentially the time to charge the capacitor that's really the problem, you know, that I haven't talked about. We really don't have a sense of what these economies are, and most students don't have a sense of what, you know, what's involved in the hardware, the multi-level caches and things like that, what virtual machines do, both in the hardware level and the software level. And I think that's really a problem. In the old days, we always got the kind of naked machine. I think the people that are getting down, getting the little processor bricks and putting them together, I think that's a feeling. But we need to go back to that so people kind of grow up, you know, on both sides of the street.
Sure. You know. Now, you mentioned objects early on. Of course, you're very famous there. So what's the state of objects today? What's the state of object-oriented programming today in your mind?
Well, I think... The state is it's commercially immensely successful, but practically I think it's a disaster.
Interesting.
I think the reality is that, you know, while many here were Pied Pipers of objects, certainly, you know, and I think, you know, led a movement towards objects, I don't think we really understood how difficult it is for people to do abstraction. A lot of the people who build software in organizations don't have, you know, the kinds of education or training in abstraction. And so, you know, as we add more and more things like F-sharp, for example, which is a really interesting language, and it's great to see, you know, members of the F-sharp team here.
Yep.
You know, and some great talent there. But, you know, when you start putting functions and objects and these things, this is pretty heavy duty for someone who just wants to write an app.
Yeah.
Right. It's not, you know, I mean, you know, they were actually sort of comfortable in VB, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, not, you know, and I know many people turn their nose up at that, but I think one of the big challenges is we've kind of exposed all the complexity, and that means that these people are kind of lost in the sea of complexity of a lot of choices, and it's very, very hard. And so, you know, it's great that we can talk in agile development about refactoring, but in practice, when you have hundreds or thousands of millions of lines of code, the tools aren't there, the practices aren't there. So I think in many ways we've kind of screwed over the application developer with the object technology. We haven't sort of come along the space of, you know, the parallel world of the 4GL. We don't have the Access or the, you know, Microsoft Access or the Excel or, you know, the 4GLs we had, and I think that shows if you just look at some of the older Microsoft products like FileMaker, right, which normal people can use and get work done, and I'm sure the, you know, the sharp developers at, you know, Microsoft and any other place would say FileMaker. I mean, you know, who would use, you know, not even a Mort would use that, right? But the problem is people do, and so I think one of the challenges as we get things into cloud and more complexity, and so how can we actually democratize the programming process so that people who actually use computers as part of their daily life and part of their business can actually program them, or perhaps in Ivan's terms, configure them to be able to do that. You know, and I sort of look at, well, gee, you know, does everyone have to learn how to set up a Hadoop cluster to do searching of large data? You know, how do we get to that? So I think that's, so the good news is we're very sophisticated. The virtual machines are very fast, amazing stuff. We've got, you know, all sorts of, you know, things in both Java. The Java's moving along now with making progress, was behind a bit, but great works in Java 7 and 8. So things are moving along, great work in the CLR. But it just seems to increase the complexity and choice facing people.
Interesting. So what do you see as, I mean, in some sense, the notion of, let's look at the, one of the things that for Splash this year that you guys have as a tagline is sort of the notion of the virtual machine in the sky, right? The internet is, in some sense, this giant virtual machine that everyone's trying to program. But it looks like JavaScript, for example, is the language that we are using to compute, at least on the client, and also with Node.js on the server.
Node, certainly, yeah.
So what's your take on JavaScript and the fact that that's so successful?
Well, I think a few years ago, I wrote a few articles, and you know, I appeared on this show, I think, with Eric Meyer saying, real men will have to program in JavaScript, and it is pervasively there, right?
Yes.
So I think it is, and now and you don't know certainly all the efforts, you know, kicked off by the V8 thing, but they really started kind of an arms race in the JavaScript thing, which has been good because now the Microsoft team is racing along there with IE9, and so I think, you know, it looks like we'll actually have real standards and real performance in the browser across things. So I think that that's really good. On the other hand, I think I'm pretty excited about Dart, although I know a lot in the language community won't be, because Dart represents a lot of what I would say are good engineering decisions, which tends to upset people who want to see that whatever their favorite feature would be, whether it be continuations or you know, where the semicolons could be or whatever it is. But I think one of the challenges for JavaScript is, because it's so pervasive, having something that it can, you know, building large applications in it. When you start building, you know, full programming things or programming environments, or you want to build a, you know, complex, you know, collaborative product and so on, and there's going to be mountains of JavaScript code in it. It's really hard right now because there's so many different ways to do things to do that. So, you know, I hope that if nothing else, Dart will cause the people working on JavaScript standards to kind of hunker down and say, okay, what is the simplest thing that we can possibly do so we can get modularity and you know, so that we can sort of do serious software engineering with JavaScript, while at the same time recognizing that HTML5, and one of the nice things HTML5 is it moves a lot of the some of the event stuff, and so it makes it more declarative. So with CSS and so on, that that means there's less JavaScript required in a lot of basic applications. But I think it's still pretty hard for a lot of the software engineering community to accept that, you know, JavaScript is as pervasive as it is. And certainly Node has caused some violent reactions in the server community, right?
You know,
oh my God, you know, I can't believe you're going to program a server in JavaScript with all that continuation passing stuff and so. But, you know, it's interesting, it's simple, and it's fast, and, you know, and I think it just shows, I think, if you build a good, if you've got a reliable engine underneath and a fairly stable spec, then people can count on it.
But absolutely.
But I think there's still, you know, there's still lots of room for innovation on the web and for mobile. And I think the real nut to crack is basically to do, you know, to do something better than the current DOM implementation. Because the DOM implementation, trying to bind JavaScript with the C++, you know, that's always a messy thing, and it's the old managed unmanaged code problem, which, you know, there are lots of cruel and unnatural acts that people at Microsoft and you know, Sun and, you know, lots of other places, Google, have done to try and do that. But fundamentally, you've got this sort of impedance mismatch between the DOM, and I think, you know, the day that somebody sort of breaks through and says, okay, look, we're going to build the DOM with a new technology, they could do that. So, you know, I think that's the kind of thing that, you know, throwing a dart in the wall will cause some people to think about. And I think it's good, because, you know, when everyone's decided that it's over and it's JavaScript, that's kind of when you go to sleep.
Yes.
So I think it's good to see the innovation. I mean, I saw, you know, there's a lot of new languages, so I think, you know, they're... but the good news is a lot of those languages actually give you the way to generate JavaScript out of them, so...
Interesting, I mean, so. Eric and Gilad talk a lot about sort of, you know, JavaScript being the assembly language of the web.
Yeah.
And so you don't actually have to program in the junk. Well, not that it's junk, so excuse me. But you...
No, that's an interpretation of many technical people, right?
Yes, so exactly.
You're just rephrasing it.
Sure. No, I mean, I actually think JavaScript is an interesting language, because it hides its complexity from users. So a lot of the people who use JavaScript, web developers traditionally, they don't really really have to understand what a closure is and stuff like that. It's the continuations and things like this. It's not something that's in the front of their mind. They just want to write some sequential lines of code that do things, and usually it always works, right? And so I can understand right from the...
Well, it always evaluates.
It always evaluates.
It may not do what you want it to do.
Exactly. You might be changing the global state without realizing that. But yeah, so there's definitely problems there. What is your take on, and I talk about that only because I know you're a big fan of the notion of end-user programming and things that you're working on these days to make things easier for people to program. Can you talk a little bit about end-user programming?
Sure. So I think one of the challenges is we find more and more in business that both business and science, that you've got people who are really well educated in their domain, really know their domain, and they really, you know, they know how to program. Maybe they program in MATLAB, you know, maybe they use, you know, big spreadsheets, or maybe they, you know, they use, you know, R, for example, which is very, very popular. And and they find it quite frustrating now to go to hear that, well, in order to get something done, what you have to do is you have to write your little stories on cards and put them on the wall or put them into a requirements tool, whichever, you know, particular process religion you happen to subscribe to. But they sort of, you know, there's a huge amount of work to try and say, look, I need you to solve this differential equation and try and put that on cards and, you know, or draw it in UML diagrams. So I think the reality is today you can run your whole business on a spreadsheet or on a, you know, effectively like an access model, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you can take that and redeploy it into the cloud in either case. So there really isn't de facto requirement. I mean, we have this notion that, okay, well, you've done this thing, you know, in Access or in Excel or even in JavaScript, right? Mm. Yeah, but that's not what real men do, right? You know, so what you have to do is you have to get yourself a whole bunch of, you know, programmers and pay them and try and explain what's everything in your head that you actually got working and go through this. Whereas in practice, a lot of the representations that people use in their way. In fact, there's some great paper going on today, you know, talking about taking MATLAB and compiling it directly to code. Mm. So whereas before you'd say, okay, well, I've got my MATLAB model, now I need to subcontract, you know, 200 C++ programmers to do this satellite management system because you can't keep running this in MATLAB, and then you come back doing V&V and say, no, that's not what the model says, and they go, oh, okay, I'll fix the code. Yeah. When in practice, I mean, with things like Simulink and some of the work being done compiling MATLAB to GPUs and so on, you basically can go kind of from your brain to code,
nice,
right, without the need of having to use a sort of manual assembly programmer and trying to translate those requirements. Because one of the problems is translating the requirements. If you really know what you're doing in your domain, in biology or, you know financial engineering, you know, explaining to some programmer exactly how this swap or option works and all the other things, right? That's a lot of overhead when you could kind of just do it yourself. So I think that's really the kind of breakthrough in productivity. The other thing is that because people tend to describe their problems in a more declarative way, mm-hmm, I think there's a lot more opportunity for parallelism and opportunity, you know, in doing this because, you know, okay, I do a spreadsheet. You know, conventionally that happens by, you know, this cell going and this cell going. But in fact, you could actually farm that out and have it run on many processors and so on. Or the example, for instance, Dave Unger did in his talk, you know, basically having a spreadsheet, you know, a big cube just evaluate, you know, in 1,000 cores. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an opportunity for the implementation finding the parallelism where otherwise, you know, you're probably going to give it to some programmers, and they're going to implement a whole bunch of C# or Java things and so on. So I really think there's a huge benefit to basically, you know, going directly from a model domain, and it will be limited. It won't be general. I think that the illusion is that there will be general purpose end user programming. It's going to be strong specific, but there are lots of problems where, you know, there's a pipeline of computations, or there's a spreadsheet, or there's a table, yeah, you know, where people are going to be able to do this themselves. And because processors are cheap, you know, they're going to be able to take their spreadsheets and run them over billions of rows, right? In which case, you know, what do I need, you know, C# or Java programmer for? You know, what, I don't really need all that, right?
Yeah.
So,
for, yeah, like you said, though, for very domain-specific problems, right? Because the model-driven development as a general purpose platform seems...
I think if your model's UML, then the you know, if that's all you've got, then I think that's a very limited thing. Mm-hmm. But we're really talking about models that occur naturally in domain, you know, financial model,
sure,
you know, biology model, you know, something like that that's got, you know, some real physics or real chemistry behind it, and for which there is a natural mapping. And I think that's, unfortunately, that's to me real model-driven development. There is a real model And the challenge has been, because of the performance of the software and the difficulty, the lack of parallelism, you had to kind of translate this by hand into code and do that and make changes. Whereas, you know, so for class of problems, but it's really quite scary what you can do today on spreadsheets. You can literally run a spreadsheet with a billion rows in it.
Yeah.
And have it run, and that actually can run a large part of some people's core business.
Excellent.
One needs to be careful when one looks sort of saying, well, yeah, but you know, that won't really work for this, because you know, all of a sudden when you remove the barriers, I mean, just take a look at, I mean, I'll just say, if you remove the barrier from Access that says, okay, I got it working in Access, I just like to run it in Azure.
Yeah.
Then I wouldn't have to worry about all that SQL server madness, converting from the thing I had working to SQL server, getting a whole lot of programmers to figure out how to do that. Why do I need to do that? Mm-hmm. Why? Because I'm not a real man, so I need to go through this pain. You know, I made it work with something simple. Why can't I just push that? Mm-hmm. And the answer is you can.
Sure.
And I'm sure that your firm and others are working on those problems. They better be, because someone else is going to solve it, because it's just too hard. I mean, orchestrating all these computers yourself, just too hard. And parallelism is, I think, for most people, intractable.
Absolutely. Even for very seasoned developers.
Yeah.
And that's still a problem that has not been solved, which we learned today clearly, and from Unger's talk.
Absolutely. I think it remains a challenge. Though I think one of the challenges that we can do is we write a lot of really slow software that takes up the few CPU cycles we have. And I think, you know, we've been able to squander resources, you know, memory and CPU cycles and so on. And I think, you know, one of the things we can do to help is we can be a little greener in the way we write our software, so we don't, you know, consume as much resources. And I think we've got, you know, object languages and things like that create this, you know, they leverage the abundance of resources, and as we run out of resources, I think we have to be a lot more careful with how we build these objects and frameworks and sort of the complexity that we put out, because the complexity is costing us a lot in terms of cycles.
Sure. Yeah. Speaking of simplifying complexity, I mean, IDEs, What's your take on the state of IDEs today in 2011? I mean,
the state of IDEs, in most cases, has not progressed since the early multi-window IDEs that came out of the sort of small talk era. I mean, there are some amazing things now. They can be much smarter. Mm. So you can just type a bit and it can figure out, you know, out of the 10,000 calls in the library, 15 that you might be able to use, whether you know whether it's the right one or not. Mm-hmm. So they do a lot for you, but in practice, for instance, refactoring, there's no story. Mm. You know, IDEs today, you know, I mean, they have refactoring, but it's trivial. I mean, if you've got serious amount of code base, they really do nothing. I think a lot of the new IDEs, the cloud-based IDEs, they're not very exciting. They basically take the JavaScript, you know, they make your editor in JavaScript, push it back, but they still recompile all the programs. Now, I'm assuming that the, you know, really smart people at the, you know, large successful companies who sell IDEs will be figuring out how they can use this concurrency and the cloud computing to do that. But the fact that, you know, I have to keep recompiling, you know, I've got a team of 100 people and we keep recompiling the same files over and over again. You think someone could be kind of smart enough to know that we've already got these and we could share them on a server and things like that. So I think there's a real opportunity for breakthrough in IDEs. And it's got to be a lot more than just, you know, sort of taking my big cumbersome IDE and putting it on the server and moving the face out so it looks like it's smaller. I mean, I know that's something that, you know, certainly the Eclipse community and the Microsoft community, I'm sure, will do. But in the end, it's really the insides of the whole IDE that's got to change. It has to recognize the fact that teams do work together, so you can bring these things together. And today with these servers, the kind of analysis you can do for programs in terms of optimization and finding things continuously and so on. And I think that means that you need a different the way you do IDEs and design and build them needs to change. And I look forward to seeing someone do that. Most of the ones now seem to be kind of more of the same, but, you know, we've hidden it in the cloud, right? Which isn't, well, that's the easy thing to do, and, you know, it's also a challenge if you've got a large legacy code base. I mean, if anyone needed a refactoring tool, it's the Eclipse team and the Visual Studio team, because they've got Code Mountain to deal with, right? And so I think if they could produce tools that could deal with their own code bases, they'd be immensely successful for other people, because everyone has got a lot of object code, object-oriented program has a lot of legacy code, and very, very hard to manage, in fact. So lots of challenge. I think it's a great opportunity for people to be doing things in IDEs, but so far most of the things I see people are doing are pretty superficial.
Fair enough. Again, and like you said, it's a hard problem.
Yes, it is.
In terms of cloud computing, we briefly talked about it, but what's your sense of this movement towards the cloud, this sort of what you're seeing happening in the industry, right?
I think it's great. I mean, clearly there's issues of privacy and security, which, you know, I believe will be dealt with and have been in some cases. Mm-hmm. It's fabulous to be able to get these extra resources when you need them. So I think it enables, for instance, just testing alone in the software industry, the fact that you can spin up, you know, 1,000 instances and they can all bang away at your application or your site and things like that. The other thing is, the fact that you can have software as a service makes it very easy to consume.
Yeah.
But also means you have to have a very competitive service, because they can leave you easily too, right? They didn't install it on their desktop. They didn't marry it. So it means, I think it puts a lot of pressure on the service supplier to provide a good service. But the other thing is, it doesn't dictate how the people building this, how the people supplying the service build their software. So I think this is one of the reasons you're seeing a lot of sort of interesting variety, you know, languages like Clojure and Ruby and F#, all sorts of people doing things differently in building software as a service applications, because they don't have to. No one really cares what language the service is written in, because their team doesn't have to maintain it.
Yeah.
Versus in the old way, the vendors really controlled. You know, basically, if you've got Oracle platform or an IBM platform or Microsoft, then you're locked to the set of, pretty much to the set of languages that they've agreed on. Whereas now, when you're buying services, you have a kind of free choice of hardware and free choice of the technology to build it with. So I think that allows the people to build a lot more. And the other thing is, it's a lot easier to distribute it, right? Because you don't have to install it. You can just, you can run the old one with the new one. People don't know whether they're running the old one or the new one, or they can say, I always want to run with the old one. I want to wait. The usual rule, I don't ever want to run until you've released the third version, and then I'll switch, right? I'll go to Windows 7 when you're on Windows 9, which is kind of the way some people, but you can accommodate all those models. So it's really flexible for developers, and small teams enter the market and build by having the resources. And I think it really lets you deal with some of these problems. I mean, before, if you said, look, I could run this calculation, but it would take 1,000, 100 CPUs or 1,000 CPUs, everyone say, no, well, what we have to do is we have to optimize that calculation. We'll have to get a team to do it. Now, if you're a scientist, you need to solve your problem, you can just go out there and you can run it. And again, so this doesn't force you through a complicated design, optimal programming kind of cycle.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, so, the future is bright, huh?
I think there's lots of opportunities. Yeah.
Yeah.
Though certainly the parallelism is a real tough problem, and that one isn't going to go away.
Nope. Yeah. But hey, it's always great to talk to you.
Thanks very much. And appreciate it, Charles.
Sure, of course. And thanks for being involved so deeply with all of this education and knowledge transfer.
No, it's a great group of people, and good to see Channel 9 here at Splash.
Excellent. Right on.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Take care.